All the Senate Elections and Ethics Committee together. We are in subcommittee, and so we're opening a public testimony for the purposes of testimony only. Representative Rosenbaum, I'll go ahead. And you want to open up a House Rules Committee as well?
Sure. I will call the Interim Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules to order. We also are at the moment one member shy of a quorum on the House side, so we're also convening as a subcommittee at the moment in order to take testimony.
Thank you. And you'll notice, folks, that the rules were dropped from the Senate Ethics and Elections Committee, so that means we're not playing by the rules these days. So. Mr. Secretary of State, welcome. We really appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us today and talk to us about what's happening in transparent campaign finance reporting, otherwise fondly known as ORSTAR. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of both the House and Senate Rules Committee, it's a real pleasure to be here. It's fun to see all of you again. We've been sort of on our own paths for a little while because we've been out of session, but it's great to have you back and great to see you. I'm really glad to be here today because I really want all of us to just take a few moments and feel good both about the Oregon Legislature, the Secretary of State's office, and good government groups such as the League of Women Voters, Common Cause, and Democracy Reform, and really feel good about what's been accomplished since 2004. And I want to just feel good by taking you back in time, just a touch. In late 2003, I appointed a Blue Ribbon committee to look at issues related to campaign finance disclosure. And at that time, it was apparent by a number of news stories that the continual movement of campaign money between political committees, sometimes between multiple committees controlled by one single candidate, that situation was making it very, very difficult for Oregonians to follow the money, which is the fundamental principle of our campaign finance system. The reality was there was very, very little transparency because of the ability to play shuffle games. And Oregon's national reputation for transparency and campaign finance disclosure was really less than stellar. In rankings of the states by the Campaign Disclosure Project, Oregon ranked an embarrassing 32nd among the states, and in 2004 with a grade of D. That's D as in doggone bad. Now, I asked the Blue Ribbon Committee to come up with some ideas on how to improve the campaign disclosure system. And one of their ideas in a report that was forwarded to the legislature, one of their ideas was continuous reporting, where we would dispense with the system of periodic reports available to the public only on paper. The Blue Ribbon Committee proposed that virtually all committees be required to disclose their campaign disclosures and expenditures more often and electronically on a website. Then, at the beginning of the 2005 session, just months after the Blue Ribbon Commission issued its report, the case against Representative Dan Doyle and his conversion of campaign funds to personal use, that case emerged into the public's eye. And the legislature really, in response to that, wanted to demonstrate to the public that it cared about making our disclosure system more transparent. Speaker Minnis and Minority Leader Merkley made a commitment to get a bill through that would include required electronic reporting, more frequent reporting, and a searchable database. The Senate, too, was committed to getting the job done, and one of your two chairs, Senator, with Senator Brown's leadership, along with support from key Republicans such as Senator Jeff Cruz, the two bodies really work together and help make it happen. Now, through all of that, groups such as Money in Politics Research Action Project, this now called Democracy Reform, Common Cause, and the League of Women Voters persistently beat the drum for more transparency in Oregon. They would not give up, and neither would we. By the end of the 2005 session, we had ourselves a bill. The staff of two of our divisions in the Secretary of State's office, the Elections and the Information Services Division, immediately began planning the new system, building it and getting it up and running by January 1st of 2007. Now, I'm not going to tell you the task was easy. It was, in fact, very stressful, and it was a pretty big, monumental task to put this new system together. But thanks to the hard work and commitment and hours of overtime and tough-mindedness of individuals such as Tammy Detweiler of our Elections Division and Jeff Houck of the Information Systems Division, ORSTAR was, in fact, born. And it was born on time and on budget. And since the launch date, we've worked very hard to make it better and better. Suggestions from folks here, from users of the system, have been really, really valuable to being able to improve the system. And we'll continue to make it better and better for individuals filing information in the system and for the public that uses the system. Now, John Lindback is here and will talk to you in a minute about enhancements and fixes that are to be completed prior to January 1st of 2008, on the first anniversary of the launch of the system. Now, I have to tell you, the public reaction to this new system has been very positive indeed. Newspapers such as the Oregonian, the Eugene Register Guard, the Medford Mail Tribune, the Albany Democrat Herald, and USA Today have hailed the improved transparency of Oregon's system. And the Campaign Disclosure Project, the group that grades the states, drum roll please, we vaulted all the way to third in the national rankings. We went from 32nd in 2004 to 24th in 2005 to third in 2006. Now, that clearly is a dramatic improvement in transparency. And the good news is the top three states in the country, Washington, California, and Oregon, were all very, very close in their total point score. Now, as some of you may know, the Campaign Disclosure Project made recommendations on how we can improve the disclosure system even more. We were pleased to see that we'd already made some of the changes that they were recommending between the time that they evaluated our system and the time that they issued their report. Others we intend to implement, and John will talk more about those. So I just really want to say thank you. I want to enjoy this together, because it clearly is something that the legislature deserves a huge amount of credit for saying this is the way we want to go. My staff really worked incredibly hard to get it implemented. And so I really just wanted to share that with you and enjoy a moment of yes. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Thank you for your leadership. I also wanted to recognize, I know that Representative Peter Buckley was on the work group, and I wanted to recognize his hard work on that as well. And I'm chuckling because your staff did EO people's work on that, and we had a lot of fun working together. So any questions for the Secretary?
Yes.
Senator Monis Anderson.
Thank you. I want you to know, and maybe you already know, that this has put a tremendous amount of work on our own local campaign staff, especially for those of us who are in targeted districts and have a lot of expenses. For those who do not have it, it's not a problem. From what I've learned, that some legislators hire a contract out to have their reporting done. I think it's about $350 a month, I believe, is what it is. That's over $4,000 a year. For those campaigns that are huge, like mine usually are, mine was over $600,000. It is a tremendous, and we don't contract out, and I have one person, labor of love, who works for me. And that is a huge, huge issue, and especially making the reports on a weekly basis and making sure all the checks are accounted for and deposited. The time frames are pretty short for those of us who have huge campaigns. And I haven't gone through a campaign under this yet. We may have to just hire out. I don't know. But I don't know if you've gotten any feedback from others who are actually doing the data entry themselves rather than contracting out and paying the $350.
I'm sure that the Elections Division has had conversations with folks like that, one of the things I love about the election staff is they always try to work with every campaign and try to help them solve the problem.
You've been wonderful.
But there is a fundamental problem, which I would argue that you would have sort of no matter what. No matter how we were doing the reporting, you'd either have it kind of when the report was due and you have a huge crunch, or you have sort of an ongoing reporting issue, which, like you're saying, a $600,000 campaign, there's a lot of reporting to do because that's a lot of money that you raised and then a lot of money you spent, and you got to report all of that. So I just remember the crunch that came every time you had to file a report. And I'm sure you remember it too. And if you had a big campaign, it was a huge crunch. So, what could I say to you? We've spread it out and made it sort of more.
It means I have to have a staff on full time, basically, even in the interim.
I have been so, I have to just say that I know that there are huge burdens that come with disclosure. But I've been so impressed with the amount of daylight that this reporting system, if you just look at the last initiative campaign process and how much daylight was in that.
Yes,
and it was really, I have to say, I was really impressed with the media. Because I was worried that they were just going to, they used to just issue a report when the reports were filed, right? This time, they actually were watching
speed
the internet and literally picking up stuff every day, which was really, there was much more focus. Well, of course, there was $12 million spent on one issue. But, there was much more focus than we've seen from the media on an ongoing reporting basis, which I think we can thank the campaign finance disclosure system for.
I think it's incredibly important that we have this. I'm just saying that my expenses are actually more now because I do need to have someone on staff every day now rather than at crunch time.
Oh, well.
Any other questions? Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's not really a question, but just a comment that, certainly those high-volume campaigns, although they didn't have to report as frequently, they did have to report electronically, and in the previous world, they had to really use software that they purchased. So I think the thing that is remarkable is that we now have a system where you don't have to use a vendor. The software is publicly available for free to every campaign that chooses to use it. And
OnRap,
you can still use a vendor, but it's not necessary to have software that you purchase through a vendor. The software is really there in the public domain now, and I think that is a huge accomplishment, which kudos to everybody. But
really, kudos to everybody.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate your presence.
Great pleasure to be here.
We're going to bring up next Mr. Lindback and Mr. Hassan and Ms. Detweiler. I was going to say the dynamic duo, but it's a trio. So.
It's still dynamic. You go ahead.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm John Lindback, Director of Elections in the Secretary of State's office. I wanted to talk to you first about the going back to the grading state disclosure report. The recommendations that were made by the group, which said you have a good system, but we have some ideas on how you could make it even better. The first thing that they suggested was that we enhance the search options by adding contributor zip code and employer fields. This was that instance that the Secretary referred to where between the time that the groups doing the study evaluated our system and issuing our report, we had already gone back and done exactly that, and in fact have gone beyond the recommendations of the group in terms of search functions. Their second recommendation was that we need a comprehensive explanation of the universe of data available and specific instructions for using the OurStar database. We really agree with that, and we're working on a tutorial that will be available online on how to use the database and an easy explanation, and that is not done yet, but that is something that's on our list of things to do.
And John, just to clarify, you don't need legislation for that?
No, we do not.
Thanks.
And then they also talked about overviews of funds raised and spent by candidates in the 2000 elections, not available online yet. And that's true, they are not, but they will be when we're done with them. Those always take a great amount of time for us to complete, mainly because they're in a list of competing priorities, but we do get them done, and we will make them available online. One of the benefits of OurStar is it will be easier to do these reports in the future because the data is available, and it will be easier to compile, and we will be able to get them done and up and out to the public faster. And so I just wanted to fill you in on those recommendations. One of the things that was very clear when we launched OurStar in January 1, 2007, and we had learned this with the implementation of our new centralized voter registration system, you get to that deadline where you're ready to go live with the system, but there's still things to improve. There will be inevitable bugs. You rely on the end users of the system to provide you feedback to, one, address the bugs that crop up, and then people will come forth with ideas on enhancements, and we're seeing that now. And I think you'll hear some ideas from the other folks that have been invited to testify today about possible enhancements, and we're very open to a lot of enhancements. One of the things that I wanted to point out to you, though, is that we have a lot of things to do in order to accommodate legislative changes that were made in the last legislative session that are to be implemented by January 1. And so Tammy here did a list for you that's included in your handouts today. It says OurStar functionality to be implemented by January 1, 2008. It fills up both sides of the paper. And it sort of gives a good example to you, I think, of what it's like to maintain and operate a system like this. You almost continually have a list like this of things that you're working on, and your ability to get to them depends on resources and deadlines and what's required and what's not absolutely required, and sometimes we have to pick and choose. But these things we absolutely have to have done by January 1, 2008. And are on schedule to be completed. So I'm going to keep my comments to that so far and sort of open it up because I figure you may have questions about specifics, and I'll let you leave the conversation where you want it to go.
Either one of you have any comments? Questions? They're speechless.
Well,
Sarah Minas Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just so long as it's user-friendly, and that's what you've been doing, and I assume that these changes are making it more user-friendly.
And in addition to that, we have things like, just as a reminder, one of the bills that the legislature passed last session changed the deadline from 5 p.m. to midnight. So for a transaction. So a transaction that was due at 5 p.m. is now due at midnight. And that's just an example of one of the changes that we need to make in order to accommodate legislative changes.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thanks, Madam Chair. John, are you tracking at all how many hits the system is getting in terms of people who are looking at the information that's posted?
You know, thank you, Madam Chair. I asked that question the other day, and we are not yet. But we obviously need to do that very quickly and to start doing that and reporting on it, because we certainly have a sense from the feedback we're getting that it's being well used. I barely run into a media person these days in particular who doesn't tell me I used it and, man, it's the best thing. And that they're very appreciative of being able to get the information so quickly and conveniently. But we aren't collecting that information yet, and I want to.
Senator Monsanto.
Will you be having training for staff when these changes come through, and
yes.
How often, or are there going to be tutorials, or do they need to come down here? Or?
We will be doing a new round of training after January 1st. And we'll do it as soon after January 1st as possible. And generally, we spread our training out around the state. And we also are pretty good about getting the word out to people about the changes that are being made to the system and the changes in the law and that kind of thing. Plus, everybody gets a new manual. We'll be doing a new manual for next year, and these changes that are required, that involve requirements, will of course be in the manual. We now do campaign finance /ORSTAR training regularly. One of the issues that just sort of drives our computer person crazy here, Jeff Houck, who worked his tail off to get the system done, is he wants everyone to differentiate between what is a system issue and what is an issue just related to law. Because it seems like they're all being grouped together. ORSTAR is now campaign finance, and campaign finance is now ORSTAR.
Okay.
And some of the either complaints about the law are characterized as ORSTAR problems, when in fact they have nothing to do with the system. They have everything to do with the law, and some of them are system issues. And so I don't know exactly if we can solve that problem or not, but if you can do something to help, that'd be great.
I just, Sarah Monson, I just wanted to respond to the frequency of the reporting. Some of us were required to report under the 7 days with the ballot measure campaigns, and just as someone who's in the system, we found it fairly doable. You're certainly going to hear from the folks who actually have to deal with it on a baseline level, but we found it pretty doable, and I know there are folks who are going to suggest that we ramp up the timelines even further, but I would submit to you, when you're on a 7-day time reporting, it's just because you don't want to miss the deadlines, you're going to want to move quicker than 7 days. So anyway, it's doable. I'm sure the Kevin Neelys and the Donna Butlers of the world will want to add comments to that. But Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. John, you mentioned ongoing training. We'll have a number of candidates who will file. We're at the deadline in March. Is it okay to tell them that they could simply contact your office,
yes,
and they will get information in March, April?
Yes. We want to get the training as soon as possible, obviously, after the beginning of the year. One of the things that we have found to be true is that people aren't really ready for training until that deadline is scheduled. It sooner, we'd be talking to empty rooms. And the deadline really, frankly, helps us pack people into the room. And our trainings have been very well attended. And we will be doing another round. In fact, you know, in an election year, I would expect that we would be doing 2 to 3 rounds of training during the year. So the training after the beginning of the year will be repeated prior to the general, and maybe more than once.
Thank you. Appreciate it. One more, Madam Chair.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you very much. I'm jumping ahead a little bit because I'm not sure how the dialogue will go here, but I noticed Mr. Neely does have information he submitted to your office, and I was curious about your reaction to the mitigating circumstances provision that we put in.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to sunset. Do you have an opinion on the possibility of us extending that out, given what you've seen with the system thus far and people's use of it?
You know, I'd like to talk that over with the secretary. I'm not sure we have to make that decision quite yet. And in fact, the secretary under law has authority to expand mitigating circumstances on his own. It was nice to have it in the bill, but it wasn't absolutely necessary. And so the secretary could continue it, or the future secretary, because there will be a new one in place right around the time that the new that the sunset takes place. They have the ability to expand mitigating circumstances. Going back several secretaries, they've been very conservative about that because they want to take as much discretion as possible out of the process of assessing penalties, because they've been pretty gun-shy about building too much discretion into that process, or they could lay themselves open to charges that they're making political decisions on penalties. But this one, we've been very glad that it's been in the bill. As you all know, we declared January 1 all the way to July as sort of a penalty-free period as a transition measure. I think that was very well received and necessary to get everybody used to the system. And we will make, I'm sure, a very good use of that provision in our assessment of penalties, which we haven't really started yet in regards to ORSTAR. Because there have been instances where people have missed a deadline or something, and it was our fault. It was a system fault. And, you know, we recognize that and have no intention of assessing a penalty in that kind of situation. Or, you know, they have a transition problem from transitioning from paper to electronics that is genuine, and we'll be able to accommodate that.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Lindbeck, I, as you and I have discussed, I have had a lot of reservations about your ability to get OnStar up and going in this time frame, and I repeat how impressed I am with you and your staff and your ability to put this new system together and have it up and running. That being said, like Senator Mona Sanderson, I have always been a do-it-yourselfer, and now I'm paying someone to do this. And this is a loss of control in some sense for me, because now something that is going to matter greatly to me personally, when we get fined as politicians by your office, you may go by the letter of the law, but we have this big red check mark against us as we go to campaign. And when it's done by a professional that you paid to do it, you don't go to your voter and say, well, some money person made a mistake and that's why that's there. That doesn't pack it. You are fined. You are responsible. And I foresee that, in light of some of Mr. Neely's comments, that when we go into this next session, when you're going to have 60 House members and, 15 Senate members doing these reports on a regular basis, that I think you're going to be at full stretch. And I wish you great good luck. I hope that some of these bugs, particularly around mitigation and fining, don't come back to haunt us all. But I keep putting that out there for you, because this gets quite personal for those of us who have to work this and have now had to turn it over to managers who we don't, I mean, frankly, at this point, I don't even understand the system, and I used to understand it pretty well, although I believe it's better. I believe we're going to the right direction. I just hope that these bugs, before we get into the heavy season next summer and fall, are a lot of the worst ones are cleaned up.
I guess Representative Berger, Senator Mona Sanderson, my comment would be, I remember very clearly, and maybe Representative Buckley remembers as well, is in our discussions in the work group, our goal here was not to design a system that people had to hire out, that we wanted to design a system that was user-friendly, for lack of a better word. If you both have some suggestions about how we could get there using this format, you should let us know. I think that would be very important.
Madam Chair, may I respond? I think the issue that I had a volunteer who was willing to do this until we got to this system, mm-hmm. and that volunteer is now feeling a lot of pressure. And so for me, it was easier to say, since there's a constant need, it isn't built around a certain time frame. You can say to this volunteer, you know, this is when you're going to be busy. You know the shtick, you know. Mm-hmm. Now I have gone to a professional person to do all the data entry and paid them to do it to take the pressure off that volunteer who has another life the rest of the time. It also means that I'm one more removed. There's another, and maybe Senator Monta Sanderson has other thoughts on this, but it, for me, I'm in favor of this disclosure. I think it is a better system, and that's why I started with the positive. But I think when we get into full campaigns statewide, a big campaign year, what will emerge is a lot of screaming and yelling around small things that we haven't even thought of yet, that will have big impacts for those of us who are campaigning, and that's what my concern. Also, it does, let it be said from my campaign point of view, it adds to the costs of campaigns because I can no longer, I have too many other things to do as a candidate to do this also. It's just a fact.
Thanks. All right, thank you very much. We really appreciate you joining us. Let's bring up Kevin Neely and Donna Butler.
And then, do you have no members going to the Legislative Council Committee?
I'm Representative Hunt is the only one.
Okay. Maybe we can just continue and bring up here. Oh. Someone you like. Just a thought.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Okay. Because we're already running behind.
Right.
Do you want to start down?
No.
All right. Mr. Neely, take it away.
Madam's chairs. I don't know what the right word is, but thank you very much for inviting me to testify today. For the record, my name is Kevin Neely. I operate a company called C&E Systems, and we do, in fact, do C&E work in campaign finance reporting. As Senator Mona Sanderson has said earlier, there are companies that do this. You're looking at two people that own companies that do these things. Just a little background on our company. We have now 100 campaigns that we file in OreStar. We just crested the 100 mark this past week. So we are very familiar with OreStar and very grateful, in fact, for how well OreStar works in most instances. I would say, having just got off of 20 campaigns that were on 7-day reporting, but we also handled both the ballot initiatives, and I looked at the Yes on 49 campaign, and we filed just about 3,700 transactions within that 7-day reporting period. And what I can tell you is the experience was not for the meek. It was probably about a 14-hour-a-day job, and often we had two staff people working on it, and these are people who are experts, absolute experts in campaign finance reporting. I would think that there are, and to boot, our filing system, we use an in-house data entry system that is much faster, and simpler to do the data entry with. And so I do think and take to heart what Representative Berger said and what you all know, when we get into the real heart of the campaign season, this is going to be a tremendous amount of reporting. So all that being said, you have in front of you probably twice now a letter that I authored to Mr. Lindback. That letter fundamentally says that I think that OreStar is a great system. I do think that the changes it's made, and I can tell you that we get calls now saying, so we saw this on the C&E report. Can you tell us what this is, or can you tell us what that is? Clearly, people are using OreStar, and they're learning a lot about their campaigns. And I can also tell you that campaign managers are probably the most frequent customers checking on their own campaigns, calling us saying, what is going on? And so the system is being used. It's effective. And like all systems, it can, there are some changes that we've identified that might be helpful. I can tell you that fundamentally, my core concern about ORSTAR is staffing levels that the Secretary of State's office has to implement the system. We work with Tammy all the time and Jeff all the time. They're the two points of contact we have for all things ORSTAR. Frankly, I think they handle all things ORSTAR. And a system that's this complex, that has to serve this many people, where there are so many critical needs that are obviously the list that Tammy handed out to you, time sensitive, there's very little flexibility in the system right now to create enhancements. And the things that I ask for are almost always enhancements, things that would make my life easier. They wouldn't necessarily make their lives easier, but they would certainly make my lives easier and save a lot of time for the staff at CNE Systems. And so I do think one of the core issues that needs to be taken up by this assembly as we move forward with the implementation of ORSTAR and improving ORSTAR is ensuring that the Secretary of State's office has adequate resources to not only keep the system up and running all the time, but to make some strategic improvements. Instead of always just staying one step ahead of the law, it would be great if we could get two or three steps ahead of the law so that we can get, as I said, some things that would simplify the use of the system. I'm not going to go into details. You have my letter to Mr. Lindback. I think that from my perspective, one of the things that I heard John say earlier that is most important to me is that distinction between ORSTAR and campaign finance. Mm-hmm. From my perspective, we can work with ORSTAR. We can work to get some improvements done. The most critical improvement, and I think you'll hear this from Donna as well, is the reports function. We absolutely have to have better reporting for the people who are managing the money. The reporting is probably adequate for the people who are out there just checking to see how people are spending their money. But when we sit down with the bank statement and the report from ORSTAR, it's almost impossible to reconcile the two the way the system is currently running. It requires us to download multiple times from the Secretary of State system. It requires us to move it and ship it into an Excel format in many instances and try to order it in some way that we can better understand and excise out things that don't actually impact the bank amount and do impact the bank amount. I don't want to get too complex about all of these things, but in a world where most people don't even balance their checkbooks anymore, it is really important that we do, not only because we don't want to get a fine, but because that's the way that we can be honest with all the people out there that are using ORSTAR. They can be assured that, in fact, the information they're seeing is accurate and timely information. And so the most important thing is to get a new some enhancements on the reporting side. As you've seen from the materials the Secretary of State has provided you, they don't have a lot of resources to do that with, and they have a lot of pressing issues. That's ORSTAR. I want to take about 2 minutes, I hope 2 minutes, to talk a little bit about campaign finance, which I think is the bigger issue, and you're going to hear a lot about it, I'm sure, from other people today. For me, the biggest challenge with the ORSTAR system is that we have put a huge additional burden on treasurers, on people who do the reporting, and on candidates. And we put incredible time pressure on these, on filing these transactions accurately. And we haven't had any relief on the what happens if you don't do it right side. And it's absolutely critical that we take a close look at the penalty matrix and at the fining structure that we have here. Fines are my worry here, and I think we heard a little bit of that from Rep. Berger, is that there are going to be an extraordinary number of fines that come out of this and penalties that come out of this system. When you're on 7-day reporting, the thing to remember is we have the treasurers, the professionals that do this work, have absolutely no opportunity to cure an error. We have no way of knowing what's happening with the bank. If we don't write a check down, or if we don't hear about a contribution, or if we don't hear about an in-kind in a timely way, we have, after 7 days, the bell has tolled on that, and we're done. We're already in the fine period. And so now the decision is, how big is the fine going to be? And my worry with the fine system isn't so much how big is it going to be. It's going to be big or it's going to be small. My worry is that at some point it's going to be so big that it keeps people from actually reporting. That's my concern. You want an open process. You have to have a fine process that doesn't push people away from reporting after the fact. Right now, once you get 45 days away from the date of the actual infraction, I wrote a check for $5,000 on the 15th of the month. 45 days after that. So if I wrote a check for $5,000, I'm going to get a bank statement at the end of the month. If the individual I wrote that check to hadn't cashed that check by then, and I hadn't heard about that check, I still wouldn't know about it even when I got the bank statement. So we're now at 15 days, or maybe more like 21 days when we actually get the statement. So we have to wait a whole nother month. The next bank statement comes. We're at 45 days. We finally see that $5,000 check get cashed. Oh, my goodness. We forgot about it. We didn't hear about it. Maybe the candidate wrote it. Maybe the treasurer wrote it. It didn't get properly reported. Whatever the reason, we now see it on there. It's 45 days late. It's a $5,000 fine. Did we purposely try to game the system? Nobody tried to do anything other than be as honest as possible. But there was no opportunity to cure that infraction until it was already too late and we already incurred a full 100% fine on that amount. If it was $10,000, it would have been $10,000. $20,000, it would have been $10,000. I mean, it's, again, one of the big challenges that I encourage you to look at as you move forward is how can we modify the fine system to acknowledge that we don't file seven times anymore. We file thousands of times.
Mm-hmm.
We have thousands of opportunities to get a fine, and it's absolutely critical that there are two things. One, that the fining structure acknowledges the change in the system, and I can tell you that the Secretary of State's office has made one minor modification. First 30 days, they've cut the fine in half. I really appreciate that. That at least gives us a fighting chance to get the bank statement and reconcile things. But again, my worry is once you get out 45 days out, all of a sudden now there may well be a disincentive to file it. Well, if I don't file it for 10 years, then I'm going to still have the same fine. So, again, that's one of the things that I'd ask you to look at as you guys move forward. That may just be a rulemaking thing for the Secretary of State's office. Obviously, that's in my letter. I've discussed it with them ad nauseum. I'm sure they're not surprised to hear me talking about it today. I worry that if we keep going down this path, none of you will have treasurers. Just not going to happen. I'm not willing to be your treasurer at some point, and certainly volunteers aren't willing to have this amount of pressure on them. So apologize for taking so much time. If you have any, I'll turn the floor over to Donna.
All right, 10 minutes? Okay. All right, but don't need me.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Oh, can you go?
Yeah. Oh, okay. I'll just keep going then.
Okay, and Madam Chair, I'm wondering if, I'm sorry to do this to the witnesses, but because we do have a quorum on both sides of the aisle at the moment, should we briefly adopt our rules?
Why don't you go do legislative council and come back, and then we'll do rules adoptions.
Great.
If that's okay. And we'll listen to Ms. Butler.
Okay.
Right. Don't worry, we're not going to forget her. Welcome. Good to see you.
I'm a little hard to forget, as my clients will probably tell you. My name is Donna Butler. And I am the owner of Capital Accounting Service. I am also a certified public accountant. And I realized when I was writing some stuff up today is in about 9 months here, I will have been in public accounting for 30 years. And for 20 of those years, I was the messed up client expert for one of the largest firms here in Salem. So I actually know how people keep books and how they don't reconcile their accounts and how they try to comply with tax law. And the Oregon Your Star reporting system, and specifically the statutes, basically require your campaign committees to close their books 365 times a year. This has greatly increased the volume of reportable transactions, because most transactions under the old reporting system, you had one expenditure and you were done. You reported payables as of the cutoff day, and you were done with those. Under OrStar, every time you order something, you have a reportable transaction. When you pay the bill, you have a reportable transaction. The elections division here a few months ago made all reimbursements personal expenditures. That drastically increased the number of reportable transactions. I think we do need, I agree with the concept of transparency, but you also got the concept of garbage in and garbage out. And Kevin referred to some of this, too, when referring to his $5,000 check example. If you take that a step further, okay, when did we really release that check? He wrote it on the 15th, but did he hold that check for 10 days? If he held the check for 10 days, it shouldn't be dated the 15th. It should be dated the 25th. The date on the check says the 15th. When it was deposited, it was 40 days later. When was the date of that transaction? You have wiggle room now on all of these transactions based on the reporting system. This is not a good way to report financial transactions. It also goes to what Senator Anderson and Representative Berger were referring to. Part of the increase in the cost is the volume of transactions that have to be reported. There's also an extreme amount of confusion as to what needs to be reported and when it needs to be reported, which is why I'm recommending that you guys in the 2009 session really need to take a look at how you want transactions reported. I have for years been encouraging my clients to look at monthly reporting and weekly reporting. That's not 30-day and 7-day reporting. 30-day monthly reporting means you report 1 month's worth of transactions. The January transactions are due on, for example, February 15th. You report the payables, the receivables as of January 31st, and you move on. That allows time for bank statements, credit card statements, etc. But that's kind of a too big of issue for this upcoming session. And my handouts, I'm kind of deviating from them. All the stuff I put in the handouts are good, but I need to add some things based on what's been said here today. The penalty structure is a big problem, especially when you couple it with 30 and 7-day reporting. There's, like say, there's a huge amount of potential fraud and misleading information that could be filed. I actually figured this out even before you guys voted on this the first time. It's very easy to manipulate the financial condition of the committee based on 30-day reporting. You can easily report all of your expenditures, say, on day one, the first day they occur. And the contributions you received on that same day, you can report them 30 days later. Now it looks like your committee is low on money when it's not, or vice versa. How is this going to benefit the public when you look at a balance sheet or the account summary on a committee and the committee has manipulated their balances? It's very easy to do in this system. The law changes, ORSTAR, and the 7-day and 30-day reporting would not have caught what Dan Doyle did. Dan Doyle committed an act of fraud. He lied on his CNE reports. He could still lie in ORSTAR. This reporting system does not change this. What you passed in 2005 that would change what Dan Doyle did was the spot checks. That's the control you put in place for that. But you only put it on statewide candidates. Why didn't you put it on all committees? Why didn't you do it across the board? You could have done it for the same cost by saying every 1,000th transaction will be spot checked. It doesn't matter which committee it is. That would have kept the whole system honest and not just put the burden for the honesty on the legislative committees. You had $12 million spent on one race. There's no spot checks on that $12 million. And a lot of people know the Elections Division does not audit. Dan Doyle knew the Elections Division did not audit. Mr. Bradbury started out that the reporting system allows you to follow the money. I can't follow the money in my own committees. How can the public and the reporters actually follow the money in this system? If I can't do it in my own, I put it in there, I can't find it again. How is that a good reporting system? Have you guys tried to find information in your own committees that you know is there and not been able to find it? I run into that probably on a weekly basis in at least one of my committees. Reporting, the lack of reports. I brought that up in March of 2006 at the advanced workshop and asked, what the reports would look like, and would they be printable, and would they tell me what's in my balances. We don't have that now. It's November of 2007. And I ask you, how can you penalize committees for not reporting transactions when they can't find what's going on in their own committees? There's no reports so that they can go in and trace their transactions. And I don't count these Excel exports as reports for a number of reasons. The first one is, if I do a search in the public part of ORSTAR, I get different transactions than if I search in my own private workshop. I've reported this to the Elections Division. It still seems to be an ongoing problem. The public search is actually the one that's correct. The one that's incorrect is the one I get in my private workshop. This is a big problem. If you can't reconcile, like Kevin said, how are we to file these reports? Our choice when we can't reconcile is to file a balance adjustment. The penalty for a balance adjustment is 100% of the adjustment. And quite frankly, I've got one committee right now. We're probably going to file a balance adjustment because the amount we're off, it's going to cost them far more for me to find the problem than the penalty is. And I can guarantee you everybody up here is going to have penalties, and probably more than one. There is no way in this reporting system to avoid penalties. The software is getting there. They've made good progress on software development. It was released too early. We spent a lot of time debugging that could have been spent on enhancing the system in the first place. We talked about having to hire people to do your CME reports, and Kevin mentioned finding treasurers. I'd like to know who you're going to find. I have to train people from scratch. Okay. This is not a good system, and some of this is related to ORSTAR and some of it's not, but my handout is the yellow and blue. The things on the blue pages are recommendations for legislative changes that I would really like to see you consider for the 2008 special session. None of these directly relate to ORSTAR and the things I just discussed. These are problems that committees have in establishing the committee and some high-risk things dealing with bank accounts.
Okay.
Some of this was already on the list I gave for the 2007 session. So I think I'm out of time.
Before you both of you leave, this is both very helpful, both of you, to provide all this information. Are there questions for these two witnesses? Sarah Montes Anderson.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I want to go back to the audits because now my committee has been audited twice. And you pull what the state Secretary of State does is they say, we want proof that you, of the receipts that we, the expenditures that I made. The volume for my second report, and I'm not even in a campaign session, was about that thick that we sent to the Secretary of State. And that's why I have to have a full-time person. They come in every day. They go online. Thank goodness for online. Make sure that, you know, my campaign managers see what debits they had made or what expenditures they had made. We had problems with Verizon. We have a Verizon bill, and we didn't have a receipt. We pay online. And so my treasurer was very, very worried that she wouldn't have this receipt in time, because if we didn't get it in time, then we would be fined. And we talked with the Secretary of State, and I said, that's crazy. I'm sure they'll just take proof of the debit from our bank account rather than having to get the actual receipt from the Verizon. So these are small things that we are going through. But those audits, and they're happening, I think, every quarter, right? And it takes a horrendous amount of time, my staff time, to gather that, make copies, and send it down. We actually had our campaign manager deliver it because they were so afraid that it wouldn't get into the Secretary of State on time.
Well, let me clarify a couple of things, and some of them our terminology. I'm probably the only person in this room that is licensed to do an audit under Oregon state law. And what those are spot checks. And there are requests for documentation for a transaction. They are not an audit. And the reason I say they're not an audit, to be an audit, they need independent evidence from somebody other than you.
I'll call it spot checks. It was a spot check, but it's still a tremendous amount of time.
But when I talk about the Elections Division doing an audit, that means somebody comes in and they do an analysis of what's going on. They get evidence from third parties. The evidence in the spot check from a CPA standpoint is nowhere near the best. If I was doing spot checks on committees, I wouldn't be sending a letter to your treasurer. I would be sending a letter to the people on those contributions, and it could be a postcard that says, did you make this contribution on or about this date? Yes or no? Send the card back. That's good evidence that that contribution was actually made. Same thing on some of your vendors. It's a little harder with vendors, but it's actually easier to document expenditures because you have canceled checks and mm-hmm. subsequent statements and those kind of things. There's no campaign finance reporting system is going to avoid fraud. The system completely relies on the honesty and integrity of the people putting the information in the system. You have to have a system that people are willing and able to comply with. And the 7 and 30 day reporting coupled with the penalty structure is not a system that people are able to comply with. I'm doing 50 committees. Kevin is doing 100. And I'm getting calls regularly asking me to take on more and more committees. There is not enough C&E services in Oregon to handle the demand. The risk with that is you're going to have people that look at this and think it's simple, and they won't know what they're doing, and they're going to be filing your C&E reports. And you're going to find out they don't know what they're doing in somewhere probably, if they hold true to their trend, somewhere between 13 and 22 months later when all the penalty notices come out, because most committees are waiting somewhere between 11 and 22 months for campaign penalties. And I know I got some that were 22 months old this summer. They were for the September 2005 supplements. You know, that's another problem with this reporting system. If you wait forever to send the penalties, people don't know what they're doing wrong, and they continue to make the same mistakes, and those penalties grow.
Thank you. I think we're going to, I know people have questions, but I think we need to move on. Really appreciate you two taking time out of your very busy schedules and joining us today. So thank you. Janice Thompson, why don't you come on up, talk about how we can improve our grade in reporting without making it more complicated for candidates and campaigns and our managers.
I'm making no promises. Janice Thompson, Democracy Reform, Oregon. Yeah, I'm speaking about ORSTAR from kind of a more public user group that, you know, took a look at it and is using the data in analysis. And so, you know, I noticed the same things that you heard about earlier in terms of some of the searchability functions recommended by the disclosure project already being dealt with. I would echo John Lindbeck's comment just in terms of providing more how-to information, tips for use. One really nitty-gritty thing is, allowing for the downloading of more than 2,000 records. There's this kind of arbitrary 2,000 record cutoff that, you know, you got to keep track of. And if at all possible, increasing that limit would be helpful, and or at the very least, making sure that, like, there's just more information on the site, you know, that you realize if you're going to be using it from an X, you know, in terms of a transparency disclosure point of view, that you have that information. In terms of some improvements, I'm going to refer to a document that was also prepared by the Campaign Disclosure Project that does these, you know, regular disclosure projects. They put together a model law. And at the beginning of it, they have kind of like the top 10 most important things to include. And so there's 2 points that are not, you know, have been people have been talking about, are not so much ORSTAR related as, you know, the law. But one relates to, there's two topics related to expenditures. One of the things right now, and it's no different from pre-ORSTAR compared to post-ORSTAR, is that one expenditure can be coded in multiple ways. And, I mean, I kind of take a look at that from, I mean, I run an organization and I pay books and I, you know, reimburse staff and whatnot. And just for my own financial records, if I gave to my board, you know, a statement of our organizational expenses and just had these big lump sums, you know, one reimbursement for Janice Thompson without any itemization, they appropriately would take me to task. So I think just from a fiscal management point of view, requiring the itemization of those expenditures, and, you know, you can do it in QuickBooks. I mean, it's like, it's a one, you know, the check is for one amount, but hopefully, you know, campaigns like my organization is trying to work off of receipts or debit records or some debit card records that really, you know, so you know what you're spending money on. So it kind of gets back to, you know, the financial record keeping and just having that carry forward into the reporting. The other expenditure coding issue that in particular I've talked with the Elections Division about and they're open to relates to providing more coding options for expenditures, for expenditures. And this relates to past discussions that were came up quite a bit in the context of the ethics legislation during the last session and use of campaign funds. Is, you know, there's lots of, you know, legal uses of campaign funds that raise people's blood pressure because you can argue it's not exactly a campaign expense. You know, Senate Bill 10 took care of that on the topic that had the greatest nexus with ethics, which is you can no longer pay with campaign funds ethics fines or legal fees. But there's still lots of questions. I mean, I testified then about the need to increase pay and increase per diem expenses, you know, so that folks, there is less pressure on folks to use campaign funds for those allowed expenses. But my suggestion is to more provide more coding options so that people can really sort, you know, figure this out. So things like gifts, constituent services, conferences, memberships, basically office holder expenses. I mean, is this staff payment for a campaign staff person? Is it to supplement, you know, your office budgets aren't enough to, you know, have a interim staff person, so you're using campaign funds, but to provide, have more coding options so that we can just kind of really start parsing that out. The other topic, back to this top 10, which overall we're in pretty good shape on, does relate to timing. And one of the key elements, one of the top 10 things to include from their perspective is reporting of contributions, you know, faster, closer to the election. And in fact, Bob Stern from the Center for Governmental Studies, who was involved in all this stuff, the first time I talked to him after the bill passed in 2005, I thought he was going to, you know, be very complimentary, and he went right to, oh, you lost the two supplemental reports that were, I mean, he says, come on, forest for the trees, buddy. You know, but and I'm not 100%, but I just want to identify that some past, you know, faster or more frequent reporting in that window closer to the election of large campaign contributions, you know, has been lost even with the 7-day. And But I recognize, and it is one of these top 10 priorities.
And Janice,
I think we need to evaluate that in Oregon a little differently, because is that timing increase as needed here because of vote by mail? So I'm going to mention it. I actually, organizationally, I'm going to spend some time taking a look from this last special election, like how much spending and contributions there were in this last week, because, you know, as of the end of the day today, everything that those measure campaigns had to either spend or contributions, you know, should, you know, given the 7-day lag, if you will, should now be reported. So I'm going to do some looking. I mean, how much money is really coming in that last 7 days? And I'll report back to you about whether or not, you know, it's the balance between disclosure and, you know, added work to kind of increase the timeline close to election makes sense. But I just want to identify that as one of those things that, you know, the would increase the grade down the line. There you go.
All right. I was going to push back also on the 48 hours, just because I think it's fair to say that the overall level of reporting is substantially higher, and clearly we're going to get some pushback if Ms. Butler is right from candidates about the number of fines. So any quick questions for Ms. Thompson? Thank you. Appreciate you joining us. Okay. We did not take a break. I appreciate Representative Rosenbaum and Representative Hunt stepping out to go do the other committee while we continued. Let's go back up. I'll let you take the gavel while you do your House rules.
Okay. Members of the House Elections, Ethics, and Rules Committee, we do need to adopt our House interim rules. We have a copy before us of proposed rules. These are the generic rules that all the committees that have convened so far have adopted, and so a motion to adopt these rules would be in order.
Madam Chair.
Vice Chair Berger.
I move adoption of the rules as published.
Representative Berger moves adoption of the House Interim Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules as proposed. Is there discussion on the motion? Seeing none, should we call the roll? Okay. Let's call the roll.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Buckley?
Aye.
Representative Esquivel?
Excused.
Representative Hunt?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Excused.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Rosenbaum?
Aye. And the motion carries, and the rules are adopted. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think we'll wait for Senator Farioli, see if she shows before we leave. So. Okay, let's go back up to House Bill 2082 introduction. Mr. Lindback, Mr. Hassan, why don't you come on up? And I know you're, at least my schedule shows you on for 15. I'm going to see if you can squeeze it to under 10. Thanks.
Hey, good afternoon again, Madam Chair. John Lindback, Director of Elections in the Secretary of State's office. I was asked to give you a rundown today on where we are with implementation of House Bill 2082. In front of you, there should be a couple of documents. One is a letter that we sent to the Chief Petitioners dated August 2nd, 2007. I thought that might be useful for you today to remind you of all the different pieces of that bill. And then I also included our latest version of, it's a log of all the measures that have been on the ballot since 1994, and whether or not they're paid and unpaid, and the number of unverified signatures, and the validity rates, and all that stuff. And sometimes people find this handy when we're having discussions on this subject, so I just wanted to make sure you had the most current copy of that. So in regards to House Bill 2082, I'll just go down the list here. The bill, as you may recall, requires that circulators be trained by the Secretary of State's office.
And in regards to the circulator training, our online training is almost ready to go. We are ready to distribute it to the companies that hire circulators to get comment from them on it. It gives them a little bit of history about the initiative process. It runs down the rules on how to witness the signature gathering and witness signatures under the law, what their rights are under the law in terms of pay, that they cannot be paid by the signature. It will have information if they have issues with whoever is paying them and their employers, who they can contact at BOLI, if they have a problem with wage and hour issues, and how to talk to us if they have any problems with regards to employers. And it will take them about a half hour to go through it, and then when they register with us, because as you recall, they're required to register with our office, they will swear on the registration form that they have gone through this training. And the training will be available online and will be made available to the companies, as many copies as they want on CDs or DVDs to show them to their people that they're hiring. The next section of the bill was about the registration. The form is done. We're also required when they register to provide them with a badge, an identification badge. The machine to produce the badges is purchased. It's in-house, and the admin rule on that whole process has been noticed. In regard to the provision of the bill that says that the Secretary of State is to review the accounts of chief petitioners in regards to who they're paying and their financial accounts, who they're paying and how they're paying them, that provision of the bill actually took effect in July 1. We have not, at this point, gone out and demanded books from any of the people that have from any chief petitioners as of yet. We had to, according to the bill, draft a rule for that process. That rule is drafted and will be noticed November 15th, and hopefully we can get our first letter out to chief petitioners about providing copies of us of the documents that the bill says that we are to review. The next section of the bill had to do with templates for signature sheets. Those templates are to be done for the petitions that are currently on the street. The new templates under the new set of laws are to be distributed to the chief petitioners by December 1st, and that is on schedule and will be done on time. As some of you may recall, the bill includes a new provision that allows for electronic signature sheets, a signature sheet that's on one page that can be put on the internet. Somebody can download that page, sign it, and return it to the petitioners. The templates for those are to be created and out to the chief petitioners by December 1st, and those also will be done on time. Some of you may also recall that with this bill, we had an issue about implementing provisions of the bill on January 1 and how that affected petitions that were currently on the street. And the decision was made, and it was put in the bill, that the chief petitioners who are currently circulating petitions on the street will turn in any petitions they have, any sheets that they have for their petitions to us on January 4th. And then those new templates that I talked about earlier will start circulating on those new sheets under the new set of laws. And those are the petitions that will be turned in the July deadline. And so people are to turn in any petitions that they have circulated in the current year to us by January 4th under this bill. And we were to produce a rule for that process as also. That rule has been drafted, we're ready to go with that. We have new manuals and forms for the new process. Those will be out in January as usual. In regards to the process that begins in January, where people are to submit 1,000 signatures in order to get a ballot title, that was another part of this bill. We've had to spend considerable time on figuring out how we as the Elections Division are going to deal with those 1,000 signatures because the bill requires us to verify them. And verifying 1,000 signatures on each one, we were worried about the time and the resources that it will take to do that. It does turn out that we can do that by a sampling process. We have worked with our consulting statistician on a sampling process that we think will be very fair to determine whether or not there are at least a thousand valid signatures in that group in order for the group to go forward and get a ballot title. And if you want more details on that sampling process, I'd be happy to go into it, but not unless you want it. Because I don't want to waste your time on stuff you don't want to hear about. Local chief petitioners under the bill are required to file CNEs with us, and that will be in effect on January 1. And the bill also has a new provision in it that says that people that have a past conviction in the past 5 years for fraud or forgery or something like that are not allowed to be paid to circulate petitions. And we will be doing random background checks on the folks that register with us as paid circulators as a way of checking up. And that system is also ready to go. So
just to clarify, the prohibition on collecting signatures if you have a conviction within the last 5 years for fraud or forgery, it applies only to paid signature gatherers, correct?
That is correct.
Okay. Questions? Thank you. You don't get to go anywhere, though. I think you're next on the list.
Okay.
Yes. We want to hear from you a little bit about voter participation in the 2007 election, but I did want to talk about signature verification in the initiative and referendum process for just a minute before we did that.
Okay.
Could you talk to me about how many petitions you get in the course of a general election cycle?
Well, generally, by the time that it's all done, we can get anywhere from 10 to 12 petitions to sometimes more than 20. In the last election cycle, we got 13 submitted to us.
Okay, and what do you anticipate for 2008?
We keep hearing that it's going to be a big year, and we've had some submitted early. I would not be surprised if we had more than 20.
Okay. And could you tell us approximately how many sheets of paper that is?
Well,
and how many signatures?
In 2006, I actually asked my staff to produce this information. They had 290,000, almost 291,000 signature sheets that we sorted. And there were 1.6 million signatures on those sheets. So that's what we're dealing with in a single cycle.
Okay. And do you have a sense of what the fiscal impact would be if we required you to verify every single signature?
You know, I don't accept that it would be considerable. I mean, you know, my budget subcommittee would be very interested. It would take definitely more people. I don't know how we would do it in 30 days. The Constitution requires us to do the verification process within 30 days. And one of the reasons that the legislature many years ago went to the statistical sampling process was a recognition that we would not be able to do full verification within that time frame. At that time, it was 2 weeks. And then relatively recently, it was moved out to 30 days.
Questions? Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My head is hurting thinking about the number of signatures that you just talked about. You just talked about a bunch of changes you made to the initiative process as required by 2082, a bunch of changes to ORSTAR, campaign finance reporting. Is the process you're using in terms of signature verification, the sampling process you just alluded to, is that pretty much been consistent from election to election? Any changes with the way you're doing that process?
I got here in 2001, and for many years prior to me getting here, Oregon was doing statistical sampling in order to determine whether or not something qualified to be on the ballot. So, yes, there have been slight changes to the statistical sampling process from time to time due to court cases, that kind of thing, where chief petitioners have challenged the process in various ways, and the courts have tinkered with it, so to speak. not real major stuff, but a little bit here and there. And the legislature a few years back did look at the issue of duplicates and how many duplicates we should assume are in a first sample versus the second sample, and you know, it's like really fun stuff to talk about and complicated. But so the short answer is yes, it's been pretty consistent with slight changes.
Madam Chair?
Yeah.
Just a minute. I want to make sure anybody on the side. Good. Okay. Senator Monica Sanderson, then we'll go to Representative Thatcher.
I think she was before.
Okay. That's Representative Thatcher.
Yeah. Thanks, John. Now, when people's signatures have been, I guess, disqualified, maybe they didn't match or whatever, it's my understanding that those signatures, I mean, it's known that those signatures have been removed and are not valid. And with that, it brings so many, I guess, unnamed signatures with it due to your statistical sampling. Do I have that information correct?
Yeah, that's basically it. The statistical sampling process, though, in order for me to wrap my mind around it, I think about it in terms of you're looking at a small group of signatures within a larger group of signatures, and the statistician is helping you figure out that if you have one invalid signature for various reasons, what that reveals in terms of the entire pool of signatures, how many invalid signatures are in there. And there are some similarities to that between polling, sort of traditional kind of polling and survey techniques.
I have a follow-up.
Representative Thatcher, go ahead.
Thank you. I guess what I was wondering is if somebody's signature, let's say I signed a petition, and it was determined that Kim Thatcher's signature was invalid, it didn't match my registration card or what have you, whatever reason, is there a remedy for me to say, well, I did sign this, nobody forged my name, nobody added my name, I did sign this? Is there a way of remedying the fact that I had signed this, yet you have said that it's not valid?
Well, there is nothing in the process now that accommodates people coming in after the verification has been done by the counties, and where, you know, somebody can come in and say, yeah, I did indeed sign that. And that's something we'd certainly be glad to talk about in this upcoming session or future meetings or whatever. It is an issue, however, in terms of time, in that 30-day process. If we're going to build a new step in there where people can come in and say, yep, that was my signature, or groups who are opposing a petition could come in and conversely argue that signatures that were approved should not be approved, you're adding a whole new complicated step to the process that lengthens it out, makes it more contentious, frankly, and it would be something that would need some serious discussion, I think, in legislative committees and serious consideration. Right now, when the counties are done and the decisions are made and they feel comfortable with the decisions, it's done. And that is different from ballots. Mm-hmm. As you all know, if your signature doesn't match on your ballot, the county is required to contact you. That's not true in the petition process. And my assumption has always been that it's not true in the petition process, surely because of the time factor involved and the tight time frames in which we're required to complete that process.
And Representative Thatcher, I think the whole one of the purposes behind the training requirements under 2082 was so that when signature gatherers are gathering signatures, that they know what the law is so that they can make sure that the signature is valid. That's the whole goal behind that. So I suspect it's a cheaper way, though, if folks want to spend the money to do the verifying the signatures, we can certainly do that. I just anticipate that the resources won't be there to take a look at that in 2008. So, Sarah Monis Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up on that, people's signatures actually do change. My father, who has Parkinson's, I was so worried that his ballot wasn't going to be counted, I just took him down to the Elections Division sign so you can see that he can't do it very well anymore. But I wanted to know, when I go to my credit union, you know, you sign and on a thing and electronically they are able to tell whether that's my signature or not. are we even close to having that technology that would help us in this verification process?
That's a very interesting question. Some of the Washington counties are actually looking at some new technology that has electronic signature verification for ballots, for return ballots. And I think it is something that the counties and the state here would be very interested in it if we find it reliable. Mm-hmm. Frankly, I was a little nervous about it and was kind of happy that Washington was willing to go ahead of us. And let's see how it goes, because I'm not sure. You know, we're willing to be groundbreakers here, and we're groundbreakers on a lot, but I'm not sure this is one where I felt very bold about going ahead and doing this, because you know, I think as a rule, if a lot of you went in and observed county people verifying signatures, I think you'd be pretty impressed that the humans do a pretty good job.
And just to follow up, it is time intensive, and I was just looking at the economy. And I was thinking too, if you could just do some pilot projects, and if Washington County is doing it, I agree with you. Great.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. Is it Washington County or Washington State?
Washington State.
Oh, Washington State. Yeah. I'm sorry. I thought it was Washington County.
No,
Let Mikey try it.
I think Clark County in Washington and what's the one in Bellingham? I'm blanking out.
Pellets?
Starts with a K. They're doing testing on it and looking at it pretty seriously.
Will they have it up and running for the next election cycle for 08, so we can take a look at it in the 09 session, or that other people can take a look at it in the 09 session?
I'll check on that, Madam Chair.
That'd be great.
Where they are.
Okay, let's move on to voter participation in the 2007 election cycle, and I hear you have some fabulous statistics for us.
Oh, well, you know, I brought them all in the door, and Marjorie said, oh, I've already given them all that.
It's in our packet.
Marjorie was way ahead of us. We had a 59% turnout, actually 59.5% for the special election. The early returns are pretty anemic, and I was worried about that. Mm-hmm. I think this last election would be a fascinating case study for some academic that wants to look at the impact of money on an election, because you had only two issues on the ballot, and there was an enormous amount of money spent, and almost $22 million by last count by the various campaigns. The campaigns were very focused. There weren't a whole lot of races on the ballot. I think probably the anemic early returns, where people were sort of undecided about Measure 50, probably back in the early part of the return, and then watching all the ads and watching all the money being spent, and a fair amount of them were waiting until the last couple of days. We had a large return in the last couple of days, and so. Interestingly enough, even with $22 million spent on this election, and it seemed like it was a high-profile election, we've had two special elections in recent years that were actually higher, and where there was a lot less money spent. And those were two elections that had income taxes on the ballot. In February 3rd, 2004, we had a 63% turnout, and that had income taxes on the ballot, as you may recall. And in January 28th, 2003, we had income taxes on the ballot again, and there was a 66% turnout. Cigarette taxes don't seem to be nearly as big a draw, because we've had cigarette taxes on the ballot in the past, and the turnout was 44% on September 17th, 2002. I don't know. Does that mean that if you spend $15 million on a cigarette tax proposal that's worth 15 points, maybe? Some academic could probably tell us about that. I think our turnout is good in Oregon, and if you look at our turnout compared to other states, I mean, I am just blown away when I... There's an excellent website for those of you that are interested in election administration issues. It's called electionline.org, and you can go to it every day, and there is a link to virtually every story in the country about issues like this. And the turnouts in the off-year elections in Montana for those that were at the polling place were 10%, 12%, 15%, 20%. Jefferson County, Missouri, 12%, and they were acting like that was okay. And, you know, we're having meetings in Oregon about whether or not 50 and 60% is okay. I think when we look at the rest of the country, our turnouts look healthy, but I also think it's very healthy that we continue to have these discussions. Our division, of course, gets no money to actually encourage people to vote outside of the money that we give, you know, to do the voter's pamphlet. And I do think the voter's pamphlet is an effective tool that reminds people to vote. We have spent some HAVA funds, which we can spend only in federal elections, on get-out-the-vote messages, but they, in order to qualify for HAVA funds, have to be accompanied by messages that are required under HAVA, the Help America Vote Act. We are required to tell voters under the Help America Vote Act, because we are an all-vote-by-mail state, how to check their ballot to make sure that they marked it accurately, and if they want a replacement ballot, how to get it. And so we have used some HAVA funds to combine that message with a reminder that there's an election coming up and to please vote and so on. But those are really the only funds that we as an elections division spend outside of the voter's pamphlet to encourage turnout.
Thank you. Questions, comments? None?
Madam Chair, hopefully we've got some eager academics or people out there in internet land listening to your comments, mm-hmm. and that somebody will actually bite. And I think it would be fascinating to see some analysis mm-hmm. of what went on in this election.
Very interesting analysis, I hope. All right. Anybody else? Thank you. We appreciate you joining us
this afternoon.
Appreciate your input. Next up on the agenda, we asked Ron Burson. I saw Ron come on in. Why don't you come on in? Give us an update on legislation that we passed this last session and the status of the Ethics Commission. I also want to say, I know there are a number of organizations in the audience represented today. There will obviously be legislation considered for the 08 session. We continue to seek your input, and I see Kathy Eaton and the League of Women Voters here. I know they never fail to keep us posted on what we should be doing, so I hope you continue that discussion. So, thanks. Mr. Burson.
Good evening, Madam Chair. My understanding was you just wanted an update on what's happening with Senate Bill 10 and 2595.
Yes.
Okay, I'll go down through some of the current actions that the commission is doing at this time, and if there's any questions afterwards, feel free to ask me. I don't know if I'll have all the answers, but I'll sure try. Some of the current actions that's happening right now is the agency's in the middle of training a lot of the key players out there, including the school administrators, county associations, cities, including their clerks, boards and commission members, state administrators, and local jurisdictions. We are trying to train right now to the new provisions of Senate Bill 10, and kind of our theme in that training is as I'll get a little further into rulemaking here, is that we're trying to train for people to operate in the middle and stay away from the edges at this point until we can get some more concrete rules out there for them, give them more guidance. Speaking of rulemaking, this morning we actually had a third meeting of the advisory committee that was put together for rules. My plan right now has been we're trying to draft an administrative rule around definitions. I felt as though there was a lot of confusion around some of the terms in Senate Bill 10, and if we could draft some rules around what those terms mean, then maybe we could actually answer a lot of the questions and clear up a lot of the confusion around Senate Bill 10. My plan is to have this draft rule to the commission by 12-7, their next meeting, and on the 7th ask them to be able to open up that draft rule for public comment. In other words, so we can get it in the Oregon Bulletin by January 1st. By January 1st, that would bring it back to the commission by February 29th with any chance of approving that particular rule. Now, there's other rules that are out there that we're also going to be looking at, but it may take a different advisory committee to talk about. An example of that is that there's a requirement for a rule around the administration of the civil penalties that were added to Senate Bill 10, but the advisory committee that it was put together for those earlier definitions, those folks may not be the right folks to have the discussion around civil penalties. We may want to bring some people in that actually defend some of the folks before the commission, and they might have more interest in a civil penalty rule as opposed to a definitions rule. We are currently creating new forms for the Statement of Economic Interest, quarterly lobbying expenditure reports, and quarterly reports that are required by Statement of Economic Interest filers. And so that is currently being put together, and they should be on board in plenty of time for people to be able to fill those out before the April 15th date.
Online, Madam Chair?
Senator Monson?
Did you say online?
Chair Brown, Senator Monson, currently right now they'll still be by paper. In 2008 is when the online will take place.
2008 or 2009?
I'm sorry, actually it's 2010.
Okay, all right. Yeah,
sorry about that.
Okay.
I'm not wishing my life away.
I'm
the opposite of that. Yeah. Currently right now we're working with we're working with networks to distribute. We have kind of a network that we distribute a lot of the information that we find out about the bill and get those out to the different folks. An example is we get reports out to the League of Oregon Cities, the Association of Oregon County Special Districts Associations, the Capital Club, DAS Director's Office, School Boards Association. And even though there won't be any administrative rules come January 1st when the bill actually kicks in, we have, of course, opened our doors to any advisory opinions that may be needed before that time.
Okay.
And so currently there actually is one being worked on for schools at this time. The other thing is the bill actually gave the agency additional staff. We have hired all that staff except one. That position should the announcement for that position should close on Monday, and so we hope to have that trainer position in here mid-December, end of January, depending on what the pool looks like at this point. So we should have a full staff by the beginning of the year. Any questions?
Representative Hunt, let's just go from right to left.
Happy to be on the far right. I'm interested, between your advisory committee or you or your staff, has anything popped up as you look at Senate Bill 10 that you would identify as some unintentional statutory flaw that might be urgent enough to be addressed in February of 2008?
There may be. There was a couple of things brought up in today's meeting that we need to look at a little closer, but there may be some that have some conflicting meanings. An example is the idea of legislative or administrative interest. In the statute, it talks about that interest being with the person. But if you actually get back in Section 18, it talks about that interest being with the agency that the person works for. So that might be a conflict. An example is because everything under Senate Bill 10 turns on the idea of legislative or administrative interest. So if you don't have a legislative or administrative interest, it is not a gift, and you can give as much as you'd like. So that's the first question that we're asking people to answer. And so in the original statute, it's talking about that legislative administrative interest is in the person. So what you do is you'd ask yourself, a person working in an agency that maybe a vendor has a contract with that's a front counter person, do they actually have a legislative or administrative interest with that private business? And the answer, according to the front of the statutes, would be no. But if you actually look back in Section 18, it talks about any person that is working for that agency that has the interest with that contract. So it would be any employee of the agency. So if you take that broader view, which we have done as an agency, you would say yes, but there was some contention between the advisory committee on whether or not we're interpreting correctly at that point. So that's one example where there has been.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just thinking, even though February seems like it's a long way away, if there are any other things like that, I think it'd be really helpful if you stay in contact with the two committee chairs here, because clock is really ticking on potential action.
And I believe we are staying in contact with the committee administrator here, too. So.
That's Ed Berger.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Bergen. Thank you, Madam Chair. let me get it straight, if I could, what you just said. You were working on rules and definitions or rules around definitions, but you haven't got that done. Definitions are the key here. I think you would affirm for me that definitions, this is all about definitions. And that's, am I correct? That is why you're working on it first?
Chair Brown, Vice Chair Berger, that was my idea, is to work on this first. I thought it could clear up a lot of the questions that people would have if we could define some of these terms.
So will you have rules around excuse me, Madam Chair, if I can continue.
Go ahead. Sorry, Representative Berger.
Will you have rules around definitions by implementation in January?
Chair Brown, Vice Chair Berger, it will not be by January. We will open it up for public comment by January.
Follow up, Representative Berger, go ahead.
The other issue that is huge here, since it's an enormous sea change, not just for legislators, but for the whole world of folks out there, and you are working on training, but the one staff you haven't got on board yet is a trainer. Is that your testimony?
That is my testimony, Representative Berger. I have been the trainer up until now, and we've also had some trainings with the Department of Justice. Our attorney has an example. The public law conference happened, I believe, last week, and she'd actually held a class during that public law conference that many public officials attended.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Representative Berger, go ahead.
Another question. Last weekend was Oregon School Boards Association convention. Was there any training that happened since you had all Oregon School Board folks in one place in Portland, or a lot of them? Was there any training that happened at that? Do you know?
There was not. No.
Further, Madam
Chair. Go
ahead,
Representative Berger. Go ahead.
You mentioned that new forms are coming by April 15th. What about the lobby forms? The lobby forms, it seems to me, would have to be in place by January 1, because it's my understanding, and maybe I misremember, that those aren't submitted in April 15th. Those are going to be ongoing and have to be on board by implementation. Am I correct?
They will be quarterly reports, yes.
So they need to start filling out the new forms in January, and so those forms need to be done in January.
Yes, we will have the forms out before January. I'm saying we will more than meet that deadline.
Madam Chair, a comment.
Representative Berger, go ahead.
I don't need. I am not. I am pushing back hard on this agency administrator, not because I think that he's done anything wrong. I just think that we were way over our skis in asking implementation of all this by this date, and I think it's pretty clear we haven't got rulemaking, we haven't got definitions, we're kind of working on forms, we're going to be going off of advisory committees. I'm just reiterating what I said during the session, which is I just don't believe we can do it this fast. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Berger. Representative Rosenbaum, comments?
So I guess my only question, Ron, would be that it seems like a pretty long time lag if these draft rules are going to be submitted to the Commission on December 7th. The comment period, usually in my experience with administrative rules that are proposed, isn't more than a couple of weeks So why would it be so long from the time the draft rules are submitted to the commission before they would be adopted? Is most of that time the comment period, or?
Chair Rosenbaum, my understanding of the rules process is that on December 7th, I would ask the commission for approval to put those out for public comment. I would need to have those to the Secretary of State's office by the 15th to be published in the Oregon Bulletin by January 1st. Mm-hmm. You have to have them submitted by the 15th of the prior month to be able to have them in the bulletin by the 1st. So on the 1st, they would be published on the bulletin. We would hold an administrative, a public comment hearing during that time. People would be able to make comments. And I can't remember off the top of my head right now exactly the number of days, but it got past the commission meeting in January, and so then our next commission meeting was February 29th. And that would be the date that we would come back with all the public comment to the commission. So that's where the time from December 7th to February 29th.
Well, I think it would be safe to say that if there's any way to accelerate this process as in light of the comments that you just heard, it would sure be helpful. And failing that, I think you are going to be finding that you're hit with a workload of just sort of case-specific questions that it's going to be pretty overwhelming.
And I understand that. And we did look at the schedule and for the rules of promulgating rule, that was as quick as we could get it in. So we can look at trying to have a special meeting beforehand to try to do that, but there's a certain amount of days that you have to leave that open for public mm-hmm. comment. And I apologize for not knowing that off the top of my head right now.
When Representative Hunt asked you a question about potential statutory changes for 2008, the only one I heard you mention was the Section 18 potential conflict. Is there anything else out there we should be aware of as we are, at least on the Senate side, our committee drafting deadlines are coming up?
Thursday.
There was a couple other comments today, maybe some disagreement in the advisory committee about whether it needed to have a statutory change or not, and we're kind of looking at that.
Okay. All right.
We're looking at that with counsel right now.
Okay. All right. Well, counsel knows what the time frame is, so enough said. Sir Ferrioli, and we have about 10 minutes.
I don't need 10 minutes.
That's good, because we need to adopt rules.
Yeah. So the effective date is January 108.
Correct.
Okay. And the rules won't be in effect until April 08 or later?
They should be published, yes.
For a final effective date, about when, Madam Chair?
No, I think the April, because I could have it in by February 29th. It would be in by the 15th of March. It will be published in the Oregon Bulletin on April 1st.
Okay. We in the Senate have required a mandatory training of legislators to take place in December. I think it's the 10th, if memory serves. You're obviously going to be the one to conduct that training.
Yes, sir.
And that constitutes a request for advice by legislators. So what you train will be binding. In other words, we're asking you for your opinion about the efficaciousness, the requirements, etc. Whatever you train, because it's an opinion that we've asked for, will be binding. That is, if legislators follow the training that you provide, notwithstanding anything that may be written later, they're in compliance. Is that your understanding?
My understanding is that staff advice, we are required to consider that when looking at if there has been a violation. And I have come out and said publicly many times saying that if staff gives advice, even if that advice is incorrect, we will, of course, inform you of that incorrectness, but we will not go forward with the violation.
Okay. And you know that, I don't know that you know this or not, but members are going to insist that the training be videotaped so that there's a public record of that training, so that there won't be any ambiguity about memory, about who remembers it one way and who remembers it another way. I can't promise there won't be confusion just because I say it, but that's fine.
Well, I can only promise you that there will be videotaping.
And we will be providing all the information we have at this point. I mean, all these definitions will be provided to you at that point. This will be the proposed rule, and of course anybody can make public comment on that rule. So you will be informed of the latest that we have at that time.
At that time.
Exactly.
And Madam Chair, thanks.
Go ahead.
Are you logging questions issuing advisory opinions on the questions that you're getting from people now?
I think I testified earlier that we have got one request for an advisory opinion at this time.
Okay, and that's it to this date. Well, I would ask, Madam Chairman, that you keep a log, that it become a public record so that legislators will have an ability to refer to that log. Because at some point in the distant future, just about every question we can conceive to ask will have been asked and answered. And that will be a very handy training tool for legislators and others if you keep that log and make it available to the public.
And in my training, I have asked people, because one of the things that Senate Bill 10 allows us is to have staff advice, which wasn't allowed. I mean, we were given it beforehand, but now it's actually formalized inside of Senate Bill 10. And we have asked people to please give that to us in writing, even though they can call us with it, just so that we have that information for our records. And our response back will be in writing, so that, again, people aren't confused.
And, Chairman, I think there's a lot of good in Senate Bill 10. But I have to agree with those members who've expressed real concern about whether or not we are, I think somebody said over our skis. Yeah, usually that means at some point in time in the drift. But I guess this is kind of a tough question, and I want to ask you point blank. Do you have the courage and integrity to ask for an extension from this body before the end of our window for the 08 legislative supplemental session, if you feel that it's necessary for you to do a good job, to do an effective job, and to be to give those that are subject to the new provisions of Senate Bill 10 adequate time to learn the system and train for it so that they have a high probability of compliance with the law?
Yes.
Good. I'll be expecting a call from you before the 15th.
That's Thursday. Thank you, Senator Farrell. Senator Miles Anderson.
Actually, he was asking the very questions I had. I'm concerned that we are implementing legislation where we don't have the rules written, and would an extension be appropriate? I know my office has called you several times on saying, is this reportable, is this not, and what about this? And you have told us to be on the conservative side, but I just am very concerned that we aren't ready yet.
Thank you. Representative Thatcher.
Oh, I might as well join the fray here. Thank you very much. You know, Ron, thank you for your report to us, and appreciate the work you do. And, yes, he's a constituent of mine. I'm hoping, can you tell us, if you were able to write this bill yourself, what kind of timeline would you have established for yourself, for your office, in order to accomplish all that needs to be accomplished in your eyes?
You know, Representative Thatcher, you know, it's difficult for me to answer because, you know, with this rules process, it's been very time-consuming and very challenging because you have a lot of different viewpoints coming in, and it's been pretty challenging. We were lucky enough to get the Law Commission to kind of write up a kind of an overview of some of these definitions, and these folks can feel free to come up here and testify. We literally spent three meetings to go over seven pages worth of definitions. So it's challenging. So it's hard for me to say how long it would take. I mean, there gets to be a point of, you know,
will it ever happen? I mean, you can continue to go on and on and on and speak about it. Will it ever happen? One thing I will say about, you know, currently the current statutes that are out there for the Ethics Commission, quite frankly, there isn't any rules that go along with those. And quite frankly, the Ethics Commission has done a poor job in the past of actually promulgating rules. We probably should have had rules in the past that we could have simply added to this time. So it is difficult to go from basically from nothing to creating a complete set of rules that's going to give this large number of people guidance so that they stay out of trouble, so that they do it correctly. So, I mean, it's really difficult for me to answer that question, but the one thing I do know by having the short time frame is the agency is very concentrated on getting this done and getting this information out to people as quickly as we can. And so on the positive side, by having a short time frame, nothing's being put on the back burner. Everything's on the front burner, and we're working very hard to get it done.
All right. Thank you. I just want to say that I hope it's not foretelling that the rules are expected to be out on April Fool's Day. So.
Wow.
Thank you. We appreciate all your comments. Sir, you got another one coming up? Oh. Representative Rosenbaum.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to comment that I appreciate that everybody wants certainty, but I think it also has to be kept in mind that this bill was a major overhaul of our state's ethics laws, and there are legal challenges that are already either mounted or certainly publicized. So to some extent, you know, I think that the implementation of a bill this ambitious is going to be evolving as challenges are made. There certainly were people who did not really want to see the bill pass in the form that it did or perhaps in any form. So I think, you know, though I appreciate people wanting to know what's what, to some extent that may change as the real world and the bill interact. So
We have come. Oh, go ahead, Mr. Burson.
I'm sorry, just one additional comment. The one thing I do want to make very clear is that the agency has no intentions of being an enforcement agency come January 1st. We're still going to be an educational agency, and we understand that not all the questions are going to be answered. So don't expect a lot of violations to take place at the beginning of this by any means. There's no intention whatsoever.
Mr. Burson, I think your comments are very comforting to those of us sitting behind the dais and those of us, those folks listening in the room, particularly given the discussion we had earlier today in terms of the potential liabilities under the continuous web-based reporting and campaign finance. So we appreciate that. I think Senator Farioli heard that, and I suspect at some point some of us will keep you to your word on that. So thank you. All right. Anything else for Mr. Burson? The Senate, unbeknownst to me, the House and the Senate have different time frames, and apparently the House will be meeting at the end of the month. Representative Rosenbaum.
Yes, thank you, Senator Brown. The House does, actually this committee will be having another meeting on November 30th. I think Marjorie had been in the process of polling the members, and I think we're up to a quorum. So we're contemplating a meeting in the morning, which I think will work with some of the members who have things the previous day, so probably about 9 o'clock on November 30th. And at that time, we will be looking at legislation, bill drafts, et cetera, for February.
Great. And for Senate members, different than the House, we each get a personal bill, which is the drafting request is due by 5 o'clock, Thursday, November 15th. And I appreciate hearing from both of you in terms of the Senate committee bill introduction between now and then, hopefully sooner rather than later. So, all right. On that happy note, anything else to come before the committee? We are adjourned.
Madam Chair?
Only if you want to.
We don't have rules.
We don't.
So
we
can suspend them, couldn't we?
I already said that.
I tried to remind them.
I know.
We can move for reconsideration of the adjournment, or we can do them at the next meeting.
I move to reconsider the adjournment that you just made without getting our permission.
Ha 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 ha!
Without objection, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Sarah Farioli, for your courtesies. Because I do think we waited to adopt them until you were present.
Yes, Madam Chair. I appreciate that.
Sarah Modis Anderson has moved the adoption of the Senate committee rules for the Ethics and Elections Committee, which I believe are the standard interim committee rules. If you vote no, I'll call.
Never mind.
Thank you. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. We'll see if it's legal or not, and if not, we'll
do
be
it
back.
Again.
All right. Thank you. With that, we're officially adjourned.
Thank you.
I'm not sure we can get away with that.